We missen 50% van ons leven, maar hebben het niet door. Waarom? Omdat we er met onze aandacht niet bij zijn. Welkom bij de Ten Haven podcast. Ik ben Rick van Rijthoven, redacteur bij de uitgeverij. En het idee dat we zo'n groot deel van ons leven mislopen vind ik vrij schokkend. Daarom ga ik vandaag in gesprek met de Amerikaanse neurowetenschapper Amici Jha. Zij onderzoekt al meer dan 20 jaar hoe we onze aandacht kunnen verbeteren. In haar laboratorium testen zij verschillende cognitieve technieken op mensen die onder hoge druk staan, zoals militairen, brandweerlieden, topsporters en rechters. In haar boek Peak Mind deelt ze voor het eerst de resultaten van haar baanbrekende onderzoeken. Het is een hele grote eer dat zij tijd vrij kon maken voor de Ten Haven podcast. De muziek die je hoort is van Wonek. En vergeet je niet te abonneren op de Ten Haven podcast in jouw favoriete app. In your book Peak Mind, you state that we are missing 50% of our lives. I found that quite shocking. How is that possible?
It's a surprising fact. And fact meaning there's a lot of scientific evidence to support this. What I mean by that is about half of our waking moments, our attention is not in the thing we are doing, the task at hand. And we know this because we've done studies where people say they agree to be in the study and will get texts anytime of normal waking hours. And we simply ask them, you know, what are you doing right now? What's your task? And they'll tell us, you know, I'm reading a book or writing a report or having a conversation. Anytime we could write to them. And then the second question is, where is your attention? And only about 50% of the time will they say their attention is in the thing they're doing. And when we bring them to the laboratory and have them do laboratory-based studies, same thing. Simple experiments, people tend to have their minds wander away about half the time. That's what leads us to this understanding that our mind is constantly roaming and it's not always where we want it to be.
Yeah, I found it quite shocking. And you mentioned that you have a lab. You have a lab in Miami. How long have you been researching there? And what kind of research do you do there?
Yes, I am a neuroscientist, and the research in my lab at the University of Miami, I've been a professor for about, you know, over 20 years, and the research in my lab really focuses on attention. So the topic of mind wandering is something we are very interested in because essentially it means attention is not where we want it to be. We also look at the brain basis of attention, what brain networks are involved, how does the brain actually respond. So we use tools like functional MRI and brainwave recordings, and we want to understand how attention works, but also what makes it vulnerable, what makes it work less well, and what makes it fail. And then finally, how we can actually train and improve and protect this very precious brain resource of attention. So we do all three things.
And I want to focus in on what you call the kryptonite for attention.
Yes.
What is that? So,
you know, this term kryptonite, we think of ourselves as super powerful, like Superman. And just like Superman gets disabled by kryptonite, for us, when we think of our attention, it is its own kind of superpower. We're able to do so many things with our attention, from our capacity to not just focus, but to really even think. Because essentially thinking is pursuing and focusing on an idea that gets elaborated. Or our ability to feel emotions and regulate emotions, as well as our ability to connect. So attention really is a superpower. And there, unfortunately, like many things that are powerful, there is kryptonite. So kryptonite for attention ends up being things like stress, the experience of overwhelm, this not like there's more that is required of me than my mind, my body, my brain can handle. So stress, then threat, essentially not just physical threat, but what we call psychosocial threat, where maybe our reputation or people's views of us can be threatened. And then finally, poor mood, negative mood. All three of these circumstances that promote these states in our own mind will degrade and deplete attention. It just won't work as powerfully as it normally does.
Yeah, and my hunch was, but you actually say in the book that is not correct, but I always thought that the new digital age is making attention vulnerable, and people in past times they didn't have that problem, but you actually you state that they had the problem as well in ancient times.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? We always think that somehow this particular time may be the most challenging that humanity's ever had to face. I don't know if that's wrong, but this problem of distractibility has been around for many, many, many thousands of years. And in some sense, we think that it's the way the brain was designed. It was designed to be distractible. And it's not a design feature that, it's not a flaw. I mean, it's not a design flaw, it's a design feature. Because if we were hyper-focused, if we were so locked into certain kinds of things in our environment or thoughts in our own mind, we would miss things, right? We'd miss noticing if a storm's coming or if a predator's lurking, you know, and our ancient ancestors had to deal with all of that. So having this attentional cycling, attention that doesn't always stay put, is actually a beneficial thing. And sure, the digital age is probably not helping us. That's probably the case, because more than ever, we're able to be reached. We now have apps and you know, social media companies that are essentially designing products that make our attention the product and make it very hard for us to disengage our attention to do other things we might want to do. So it's not helping, but it's not, it wouldn't go away if we got rid of all of our technology, is my point.
And it's also quite problematic for our health. I mean, you describe in the book that you were doing actually research on attention already, but then something happened with your health. You got a little bit paralyzed.
I mean, thankfully it wasn't that severe, but okay. I had lost feeling in my teeth from grinding. So this is a very common thing. A lot of people grind their teeth. I didn't realize I was doing it. And it was so severe that I actually temporarily lost feeling in my teeth. Thankfully, it returned, but it really returned thanks to techniques such as mindfulness meditation that helped me kind of change the way that I pay attention to my moment-to-moment experience, so that those kryptonite conditions, my experience of stress and threat and poor mood, could be reduced a little bit. And with that reduction, I was able to manage more of the kind of physical consequences of the stress, which was this terrible, weird numbness in my mouth.
Yes. Ah, and you used the word mindfulness now. You, in the lab, you did quite a few research with different techniques, relaxation techniques, but also mindfulness. And what I found quite funny is that you were actually quite reluctant to use mindfulness because of your own upbringing. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, it's kind of funny, because you'd think, and I'm an Indian woman, I grew up in a culture, even though I grew up in the US, of course, my home life was very much the immigrant Indian experience. So my parents practiced meditation, it was around us. And I wasn't unfamiliar with it, but I actually did not think that it was a serious endeavor, that the lens of science, especially neuroscience, should be, you know, investigating. But, you know, I really had to change my opinion on this, because we tried so many different things. Remember what I said before, that my lab is interested in understanding how attention works, what makes it fail, which we already talked about with the kryptonite, but also how to make it stronger and more resistance to failure. And so we became very curious about different techniques, and none of them were actually reliably holding up. So they might work for temporarily, but then the benefits go away. And I was introduced to the concept of mindfulness and meditation more broadly is as a scientific pursuit by a very senior colleague of mine, a neuroscientist named Richie Davidson, who mentioned that he was just starting some research in his lab. This was back in the early 2000s, to look at mindfulness meditation in monks, actually monks that were part of, you know, His Holiness the Dalai Lama's enterprise that were coming to this lab, and he was finding that there were beneficial effects. So I knew that it was a serious thing that could be studied now, just because I trusted him and respected Richie Davidson. So I decided, for my own personal interest, just given my stress levels and my own numbness in my mouth, that I'd start practicing. And really found that it was quite beneficial to me. And very surprisingly, that it had a lot to do with attention. In fact, the central instructions were about paying attention. And what I decided to do after I found that it was beneficial is I got extremely curious and said, let's see if this is just me as a special case, or if other people can actually benefit their attention if they practice this. And let's bring all the tools from neuroscience that I have that study attention to this endeavor. And so that was the really exciting part, is that we were able to actually test out with our laboratory-based measures of attention whether mindfulness training had an impact. And thankfully, I wouldn't be probably talking to you if we found it otherwise, but that's what we found. We found that not only was it effective, but it could be delivered very efficiently. You didn't need to be a monk studying and practicing for years. You could do it as little as 12 minutes a day and benefit.
Yeah, that's great. That's great to hear. I mean, that's a great finding. And I want to come back on the 12 minutes per day. But first, I wanted to highlight something that I found very special about your book. And that is that the test group that you use aren't monks per se, but actually maybe groups that we don't really associate with mindfulness. Military people, you firemen, judges, really people who work under high pressure situations. So was that the starting point of your research? Was it something that you really wanted to find out what happens there? Or why did you choose those groups?
Right. Well, so here's the thing. If we think back to the conditions that can disable attention, stress, threat, poor mood, there are certain professions, I mean, all of us have to deal with those things in life as human beings, but for some professions, the circumstances in which those people have to perform professionally are characterized by things that are stressful, threatening, and actually can result in a lot of negative mood. So, right, military service members, first responders, medical and nursing professionals, and then a whole other bunch of people, you know, for whom we never want their attention to lapse. If a firefighter is mind wandering and is unable to do his or her job, that's a real problem. Or think of a surgeon. You'd never want a surgeon's attention to lapse. Same thing with a soldier. So all of these were professions where I knew they're probably going to be vulnerable, because we know about attention being vulnerable under those conditions. But we need them to perform at their best. So what was exciting to me was partnering with those kind of groups who had stress, you know, in the way because of their profession. But so did I as a professor. And I think many of us experience high stress circumstances, even if it's not physically life or death, it can certainly feel like it has life or death consequences for us. And we were right in the sense that when we look at these groups under conditions that are even the preparatory phases. So for soldiers, for example, pre-deployment training, they haven't even been deployed yet to a war zone. They were just preparing to deploy. And under those conditions, their attention gets worse if we track them over 8 weeks or 4 weeks. So I knew that they were vulnerable in the way that we kind of hypothesized or predicted they would be. And then the mission became, can we actually offer people training even when they're experiencing high stress? And yes, we did. And what we found was that they benefited also. If you give a soldier, for example, who is undergoing training that may deplete attention, mindfulness training, and that person ends up practicing regularly over 4 weeks, for example, their attention will not decline. Their mood stays stable. Their stress levels don't go up. So that's all very, very encouraging, that this is something that, just like physical exercise, we can do with the mind. We can train our attention with mindfulness training to protect it and to strengthen it. And that has benefits for our ability to think, to feel, and to connect with other people. So that's how we came upon working with those groups. And I think you're right. They're not the usual groups that you think about. But that's sort of my point, is that these are not practices reserved for only certain kinds of people. We all want to have better access to our attention because we need it, frankly.
Yeah, we need it also to live more ethical lives, I guess. I mean, one of the things that I found fascinating using mindfulness in a war situation is that it can reduce casualties, civilian casualties. I'm not sure if I'm stating it correctly, but I mean, that's a big thing, I imagine.
I mean, there's so many contexts, including, like you said, military, in which errors are going to happen. It's unfortunate. And people, like you already mentioned, you know, oftentimes, even though our training says to do certain things, there's complexity, there's uncertainty, ambiguity, and things can go in directions we don't want. But when we have fuller access to our attention, the chances of that happening are reduced. So that, yes, the errors made in actually, you know, these kind of shoot, don't shoot scenarios, for example, we don't have as many casualties. And this is not just about the military, by the way. This is something that I think will now start being explored more in the context of police officers, for example, and even other professions where we just don't want to make mistakes that are a natural part of a high stress circumstance, so that people don't have unnecessary problematic consequences. Because frankly, the ones that suffer often are the people themselves. Nobody wants to make these errors, but when they're made, they're lifelong for those that actually make them. And nobody wants that. So I think that this is hopefully a way for all of us to think about in our own lives, how to train ourselves so that we feel more capable, perform better, and even more fulfilled, frankly.
So you do also think that less people would be suffering from other common health issues like depression, anxiety, burnout, if more people would train their attention?
Well, we know, for example, that when people experience those things, their attention is compromised. Now, if your attention is compromised, the chances of you making mistakes is going to increase. And frankly, the chances of you continuing to experience stress, depression, et cetera, is going to increase. So it becomes a terrible kind of loop that you're in. It's a downward spiral. To break out of it, we need something, right? And circumstances may not change. So there is plenty of evidence already to date currently that mindfulness training can help reduce stress, reduce burnout, improve psychological health and reduce the symptoms of depression. And what I'm finding is that actually a lot of this may be tied to an improvement in our ability to pay attention. It may be the thing that drives positive change with mindfulness training.
And you state in the book, you give also a lot of practical exercises, that 12 minutes a day can be enough to help the brain and make attention more to make attention better.
Exactly. So this is where we really wanted to find a minimum effective dose. What's the least amount of time? These are time pressured people, like all of us, frankly. And we went on a series of studies. It took us about 8 years to figure out the prescription that might be what the minimum effective dose is. And what we found is it's around 12 minutes. We found this because those people that practice about 12 minutes or more a day over a kind of a 4-week interval, they protect their attention and can even strengthen it, even if the circumstances are high stress. But those that practice less than that really don't seem to benefit. So, you know, I would encourage people that are interested in beginning this kind of a journey, start out small, like don't start out with 12 minutes, but ramp up and then think of it like your daily mental workout in the same way we do physical exercise to stay physically fit. We can think of mindfulness as a way to stay psychologically and mentally fit.
And do you have one exercise that is your favorite for yourself that you do very regularly?
I do. You know, I really, there's a suite. There's four that I've offered. And I think the power of these practices is to try out all of them. And mm-hmm. then I will kind of pick and choose. So I do two very often. I'll do what I call in the book, the find your focus practice. Sorry, find your flashlight practice, because I describe one type of attention as a flashlight or a torch. And really, the key is not to just be able to focus our attention, but to be able to know where our focus is so we can redirect it when we're off track. So I like that practice very much. And then there's another one I do often, which I describe as a connection practice, or sometimes it's referred to as loving kindness. It's this way of wishing ourselves well for our health, our psychological well-being, our safety. And it's not really like a mandate or visioning or something like that. It's just a well wish. And in some sense, it reminds us to use our attention to support ourselves in everything that we do.
Great. Yes. I found the loving kindness meditation also one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And what will your future research focus on?
You know, we're very interested in continuing to look at what I call scalability, getting these kind of effective practices that have scientific evidence behind them to more people. So we're looking at things like training trainers to train other people. And it ends up that when you want to train people up fast, you need people that know about the lived experience. So for example, we have human resources professionals who get trained to deliver mindfulness, and we track their attention. to other people and in an organization like a large company. We just published a chapter on that. We're also looking at, for example, military spouses, not just service members, but spouses. We train them over 10 weeks to learn how to practice themselves in various mindfulness techniques and then deliver it to fellow spouses. And then we see the impact on those spouses and they're benefited. So this is a way to kind of scale the access and availability. And it's much better to learn from somebody who knows about the challenges of your particular lifestyle than an outsider who does not. So that's one very exciting area. We're also really doing work on much more efficient strategies to disseminate mindfulness. So apps, for example, smartphone apps. There's a lot of apps available. So we want to add to the rigorous evidence to see which ones actually help and under what conditions.
Great. Oh, great. Yeah, I'm looking forward. Are you going to develop an app yourself or more curating apps?
No, we do have an app that we're using right now for research purposes. So we can very precisely track how many minutes were done. And then in the moment, track their mood before and after they practice. So we don't really right now have plans to make that commercially available, but we're getting all the data to see what the impact is every time somebody practices.
All right. I want to thank you so much for having this conversation with me. It's been great. We've learned a lot.
And thank you so much.
Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Leuk dat je luisterde naar de Ten Haven podcast met Amici Jha. Wil je meer weten over haar boek Peak Mind? Kijk dan op uitgeverijtenhaven.nl. Wil je op de hoogte blijven van nieuwe afleveringen? Abonneer je dan op de Ten Haven podcast in jouw favoriete app. Tot de volgende keer.